Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. As you can tell, I am sitting in a hotel room. I am in lovely Portland, Oregon right now, getting ready for Hoop Summit that starts tomorrow on Tuesday with practices for the World Team and Team USA. Going to see some of the best young players in the world, such as John Montero. I think all of the high school kids are here. Anthony Black just got added to the roster. I'm excited to go see a bunch of interesting draft prospects for both the 2022 and 23 NBA drafts. But first, we're going to talk MVP today. The schedule this week, we're going to do three pods. We're going to do this one today with lovely guest Matt Moore, who we will get to in a second. We're going to do one on Wednesday, I believe, with Matt Penny, recapping everything at the Final Four. And then later this week on Friday, I've got one more coming on the NBA. We're going to be moving a little bit more toward NBA coverage now that the playoffs are about to kick off. But first, Matt Moore from over at the Action Network, one of my oldest basketball friends, colleagues, the person who is mostly responsible for my career. Matt, what's going on, man? How you doing?
I'm good, man. It's good to talk to you. It's been a minute, so I'm glad to be on with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I feel like every time we talk, we rarely get to talk about basketball things, and I'm so glad that we get to talk about basketball because I don't think anyone has done more comprehensive and intelligent MVP breakdowns this year than what you have. You have gone through every candidate, I believe, outside of Ja Morant and maybe Luka. Is that correct? And broken down the case for every single one.
Yeah, I'm working on Giannis right now. I've had to wait because the arguments are so good and they're going down to the wire. I'm on Giannis right now. I've done Ja. I am writing Embiid and Giannis this week and then finishing up with Jokic probably for Monday.
Yeah, Matt has done incredible work at Action Network this year. Please, I beg you, if you're looking for intelligent, well-informed MVP takes, this is the person to read, in my opinion. Like, I can't emphasize that enough because you go through every single possible argument within these things, and I think it's really interesting. And before we dive into each candidate and kind of talk about just their general case for this award this year, I do want to talk about the conversation a little bit because it feels like the conversation that's happening surrounding MVP has almost become like this litmus test or like culture war almost for how you discuss basketball and what you think of basketball and how your brain processes basketball almost. And it's been enormously frustrating. And I feel like the conversation has only worked toward denigrating a lot of really, really great basketball seasons as opposed to accentuating the fact that legitimately, I think there are three, like, no doubter in typical years MVP cases this year in Nikola Jokic, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Joel Embiid. So what are your thoughts on this surrounding MVP race conversation? Because it's been bizarre to track, I think.
Yeah, Jokic causes a lot of these problems, not necessarily from his supporters. They contribute to it like all fans do, but mostly from the fact that because he confounds us and because he does not fill the typical description and archetype of what we define as greatness, people have a really hard time accepting it. Like, people are just have this cognitive dissonance with him. And so I think what happens is, okay, you watch Nikola Jokic, not you or you or me, but like average person, like watching Nikola Jokic, like average person that works on a TV show, like they watch Nikola Jokic and they go, okay, that doesn't look like an MVP. He's slow and plodding and like he passes a lot and he dunks sometimes, but not really a lot. And he's not hyper explosive, and he's not just like powering through for a monster dunk and all these types of things. And so there's a cognitive dissonance, and I can't reconcile that cognitive dissonance between what I think of as a great NBA player and what this guy looks like. And so that dissonance then creates tension, and that tension is then expressed in, well, then the arguments must be bad. And so it turns into, oh, well, you just like him because of the numbers. That's it. It's just because of the numbers. And it's all about these acronyms and these complicated stats that we know are flawed. And look, this player ranked well on this list, and he's not very good. So clearly we throw the entire metric out and all these types of things.
You're literally just subtweeting Nick Wright right now.
I love Nick. That's the thing. I love
Nick. So do
Nick.
I. That's the thing, too. Like, I really like Nick.
Yeah, Nick's endemic, though, I think, of the argument in that, like, there's just this idea that you have to be kind of in tune with a traditional concept of a visual aesthetic in order for what you do on a basketball court to matter, which I think is particularly striking given that the people – I'll say this. Jokic is fascinating in that he's one of the rare cases where former players and stats people – finally meet. Like, that's the area where that thing combines. If you pay attention, like Reggie Miller, Isaiah Thomas, Kendrick Perkins, like Richard Jefferson, like the former player pundit group, surprisingly, is in Jokic's camp. They're like, look, man, I don't know what to tell you. Like, dude's a problem. Like, he's a problem. And it's they don't use that stats argument. And so, like, I'm writing the Jokic article later this week, and the challenge I've given myself is we're going to do it. We're not going to list the advanced. We're not going to use that. I'm putting it in its own section, and we're going to talk about everything around it. Giannis, honestly, I think is more of it just gets into more of the conversation of, like, the fatigue factor. Like, Giannis
is
right.
You know what, though, too, with Giannis? Like, I think that there is this weird – aesthetic argument with him too.
I agree.
Because he doesn't have this, you know, incredible bag of tricks that Kevin Durant has. He doesn't have the hulking, bruising footwork and post game that Joel Embiid has. He's just a fucking wrecking ball in transition. And his work to improve his mid range, like, actually pretty dangerous as a mid range shooter now. I don't feel comfortable leaving him open, at least like whenever he's stepping into one coming off a ball screen. So, it's tricky there too. Like, it does really feel like, to an extent, there's an aesthetic argument with Giannis. There's this bizarre, completely aesthetic argument with Nikola, and then there's everyone else.
And I think what's interesting is, you know, a lot of this comes from just like Embiid fits those traditional categories, and Embiid is he's got the market, and there is obviously there are just connections that interweave with when you play for an East Coast city, you're going to be a little bit more tied into certain media connections. Like, ESPN's very Embiid friendly, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Embiid's very, like, you should be. Embiid's very subtle. You should not be Jokic friendly. Jokic doesn't want to do interviews. Jokic hates doing media. So
what does Nikola do at the end of every year? He literally goes to Serbia, and they have to get his wife's phone number in order to contact him. They go, like, every other star in the NBA, someone from the organization is probably talking to them on a daily basis. With Nikola, they can't get a hold of him. Cause he just wants to be left alone.
Yeah. So I completely understand that, but that winds up, I think, tailoring some of the conversation. And I understand one of the frustrations from Sixers fans, because Embiid was in the lead last year before he got hurt. He really was. Yeah. He was in the lead. And then he was in the lead this year. And then all of a sudden, it's just like he's just not going to wind up with it. And the problem really is that when you get into these arguments, like, for me, Jokic and Giannis are extremely close. And I've shifted. This has been a hard Westbrook thing where I've shifted four times in the last week on it.
Right.
The problem is I've worked really hard to try and build a framework for Embiid, and I'm writing it, and there's a case to be made for sure. Like, Joel Embiid, if he won MVP, would be a very deserving MVP. Like, he's having an MVP worthy season.
Yeah,
it's just a matter of if I start stacking him up against Giannis and Joker, that I start to be I think this is two guys, and then there's Joel, and that's going to be frustrating given that Joel's been in pole position twice. And that's why, like, you've heard like these arguments that literally are just like, just give it to him. Just, he deserves it. Just give it to him. And I'm like, I'm sorry. That's not the way that I do this. Maybe somebody will just be like, yeah, I just got to give it to him. But that doesn't pass mustard for me.
Well, and I think that as a general basketball audience, people struggle with discerning levels of greatness, right? Mm-hmm. I think that they struggle with being able to separate, you know, what Joel Embiid is doing, which is fantastic and unbelievable. And he is leading Philadelphia in this incredible season. And I think there are intangible factors that we'll talk about here momentarily. I want to ask about all of the situational contexts that these guys are in. And then eventually we'll talk about the other guys as well. I do think there's something to Joel Embiid being able to hold this Philadelphia team together.
Yep.
It sucks that Joel can't win MVP. Not everyone can win MVP. It's literally one person can win MVP. That's it. Like, I feel bad for him.
You mentioned the contextual stuff, and that's a lot of it, is that, and honestly, it's disappointing to me that this is how the season has worked out, in that everyone is kind of making the argument for why things have been the hardest for their guy.
Yeah.
And like, I've pushed back pretty hard on Nuggets fans about this, where they're like, look, we're doing this without Jamal Murray and MPJ. And I'm like, look, it is not Joel Embiid's fault that your guys got hurt. Like, it's not. You play who's in front of you. You play who you got. And what matters is what you've done with what you've got. You can't start going into this whole, like, because my problem with that has been, if you go down these rabbit holes of contextualizing in the absence of guys, then it becomes like, well, look, you know, if Kevin Durant had been healthy and Kyrie Irving had played the whole year, Kevin Durant's the MVP. Like, that's probably true. Like, KD was a badass this year. And
incredible.
He was incredible. And to me, he was like clearly ahead when he got hurt. Yep. And so then becomes like, well, no, you got to actually be able to play. Okay. All right, fine. But you're opening up the case then that it's like, all right, if you take a team that would have won 15 games and you pull them to 35, does that qualify as MVP because you had like four of your starters got hurt? Like, once you start going down those roads, that's why a couple of years ago, I had to just kind of, this is what happened with Westbrook and Harden, is Westbrook's cast was poor compared to Harden's. Now, in retrospect, it was pretty good because you got like a lot of guys on that team that you're like, oh, right, those are actually pretty good NBA players. But like Westbrook's team was way worse than Harden's at the time in terms of where we were at with the analysis. And I was just like, I'm not going to punish James because he's got a better team. That doesn't make any sense. You're supposed to have the better team. Like, you should have a good team, and you should make your teammates look good. You should make your teammates look awesome because you raise them up so much. And so the contextualization of all this stuff gets really difficult. And that's before we throw in like the complexities of Ben Simmons was out and Embiid had to navigate that, but Simmons wasn't out with an injury and they wound up getting Harden, and also Embiid played a part in the whole Simmons thing. Like, that just gets really messy. This has been a messy year for multiple reasons.
Yeah. And I think that let's talk about the contextual factors in general a little bit more. Like, the Joel thing is really interesting because that could have gone one of two ways, right? Actually, it could have gone one of like 45 ways, but I think that realistically, it could have gone one of two ways with Ben in the preseason as this entire thing is happening, right? Ben decides not to show up and he claims mental health concerns, which I'm sure are valid, and he claims injury and rehab and many different things throughout the course of the season, it felt like. And Joel could have decided, oh, you know what? Fuck this guy. Like, this guy is he's never been a competitor. Like, he's never been the guy I want to ride with. I think there's something to the fact that he stayed quiet. They played this about as well as they possibly could have. If he comes out and says, like, oh, yeah, like, I hated dealing with Ben Simmons throughout the course of the year, or says anything like remotely negative, they probably don't get James Harden for Ben Simmons. Like, it feels like that was a possibility because of how Joel handled it. And I think that being able to hold this entire team up and hold it together is a real feather in his cap. Like, I do think that that is, honestly, for me, it is a slightly more compelling narrative, at the very least. Not that I think narrative should matter in this, but to me, if I was making judgments based off of narratives, I think that it is a slightly more compelling narrative than even Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. being out, if I'm being completely honest, because I think that there were so many different factors that he had to navigate from a leadership perspective within that, that it was both on and off the court in a way that was so complicated and complex. And as a leader of an entire organization, he had to figure out a way to manage that. And he managed it perfectly to the point where they were able to get James Harden. Nikola Jokic, he basically just managed it on the court because that's what Nikola does. And that's great. And because Denver is an incredibly competent organization, they handle things really, really well internally. They had guys that were sort of kind of able to step up to an extent, but I find the idea of the way that Joel lifted the organization as a whole this year compelling in some way. I don't think that that should be a reason to vote Joel for MVP, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is if you're building your argument around a narrative concept, at least you're starting with like a good foundation. Like, I've always said this, is I don't mind narrative voters. If you just say like, no, this is like how I vote, is I think it's whatever is the story of the season, then I don't mind that, because you're at least logically consistent. Like, you're working from a framework. You've thought about it. You're like, this is what matters to me for most valuable. This is how I'm going to define it. And it's arbitrary and debatable, but you get to make those assertions. At least you're working from a sound foundation when you start from that kind of framework. I would probably retort that, yes, it's true that after he threw his teammate under the bus in the Eastern Conference Finals, that he did, in fact, manage his
that's a good point
his house very well, that after he made it to where his former teammate did not want to speak to him whatsoever. And like, look, I've maintained through this entire thing, no good guys here. There are no good guy. There's no like, man, that guy got screwed. You know who, like, a good example of a player that got screwed? Jrue Holiday in the Anthony Davis saga. Jrue Holiday got screwed. Joel Embiid did not get screwed in this situation. He contributed to it, but to your point, he didn't make it worse. I'd also probably like push back a little bit and just be like, did he not hurt things with Simmons? Yeah, I would say that. But like, Daryl was able to get James Harden in part because of Daryl's relationship prior.
Yeah, Daryl's, that's a good point.
And Daryl runs the game. Like, Daryl's a fantastic GM. So it's like all these kind of things mismatch together. But even then, like, we can debate those points. And if you start from a narrative, a framework, I don't mind that. I think it's interesting to like ask. This is the whole thing. This is what's fascinating, is that I do think in part, Sam, we're seeing kind of a shift away. This award, every fucking year I have to deal with people being like, well, MVP's narrative. MVP's narrative. That's what it is. It's a narrative award. And my problem is, I'm like, I know why you say this, but you haven't paid attention to what's changed in the voting block over the last 10 years. Like, the NBA removed local TV announcers. And they really sorted through and they started to restructure the voting panel in such a way that they were like, we want the people that are, one, most important and influential in the sport. That's why the TV people are still going to have a chunk of the block. And then two, like, who are the people that cover this intently? And then three, like, international has also got to be factored in as well. Yeah. It's why, like,
but by the way, I need an international vote. Like, what are we doing here, NBA? Like,
I gotta get you in for the Australian vote.
Like, I can't get in. I can't get in the American side. Give me the international block. I'm good. Like, I'm ready.
Smart.
Come on.
That's smart. You should have your you should have your editor lobby for that. And that genuinely might work, Sam. That's a good inroad. The largest block now is beat writers and analysts, and beat writers are on Twitter so that they intermingle with these people, and they know, like, the standard's just a lot higher. And that's why, look, the voters didn't want to vote for Nikola Jokic last year. He's not a sexy vote. They honestly got left with, like, everyone's hurt and out, and Embiid got hurt, and there's just really nothing we can't, like, get around the fact that Joker was just better. And it's funny because I thought that I thought he was a no bet this year when we did our preseason betting. And I bet on so many people for MVP, Sam. Like, I have positions on hilarious players to win MVP because I was like, well,
I have KD and Giannis. That's
nice.
It.
But nice.
Like, I'm with you though. Like, I'm totally with you. Continue on your Jokic thing.
Oh yeah. Like, Giannis was my biggest preseason position along with Steph. Damn, Steph Curry freaking lost the ability to shoot. But I thought Jokic was a no bet because I was like, look, they had to be dragged into voting for him last year. There's no way that he's going to be so good that they can't deny him 2 years in a row. He'd have to be better than last year. And he has been. And that's the problem is like the whole idea of the narrative award is getting busted by Joker in that there's not a compelling narrative with Joker. Like the compelling narrative is like, look at where the Nuggets are despite these injuries. That's really the only one that you've got. And right. I think that's a compelling narrative. I don't know that it's more compelling than like Joel Embiid's journey from the process to now, and you know the lovable troll that likes to talk on the court, and that, you know, or Giannis with like defending, reigning Finals MVP, right, coming back and doing it again this year. Like I actually think one of the things that's happened is like I don't think Giannis has gotten enough credit for the injuries that the Bucks have had. Like Ben Simmons wins the year, and Ben Simmons is a 4-time All-Star, but no Brook Lopez the entire year, and Drew and Chris were like in and out for most of the first 3 months of the season, and it was basically just like Giannis trucking dudes every night to keep them afloat. So the narrative context of all these things is really tough, which is why I think it's so important from where I'm at to just be like, look, we got to focus on what happened on the floor. What's the basketball component of this? Let's get to that root, and then we can talk about most valuable.
Yeah, I think that there are probably 6 or 7 clips of me this year saying, oh, there's just going to be voter fatigue on Nikola. Like, there's no way. Like, Jokic is not winning MVP. It's just not going to happen because there's no way that voters are going to be dragged to it. Like, there's no way a big enough portion of the voting block is going to be dragged to it. I am surprised that we've gotten here. Like, I'm actually really happy and really pleased with the voting block of the league that they are willing to entertain this. Like it might come down to where they pick Giannis. It might come down to where they pick Joel Embiid. Yeah. I am proud of the voting block on some level to where they're willing to get past this. And I think it says a lot about what you spoke about earlier in terms of the changing and shifting voting block of the league itself. More analysts, more beat writers, it seems like we are coming into an era of there being more intelligent basketball analysis, which is really, really important. And I think it's valuable. Now, I do want to speak very quickly before we dive into the other three about some of the other MVP candidates, because I do find it interesting that there seems to be like a bubbling case for a couple of guys. Like everyone wants to push Devin Booker into this conversation. And I love Devin Booker. I think that these arguments are more first team all NBA than MVP comparatively to the other three guys, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think it. The tough part here, again, if you have a framework, I'm okay with it. We can disagree, but I'm okay. Then it's not like, all right, your argument's bad. As long as you have a good argument, then this stuff is arbitrary, and we can defy what's valuable. If your whole starting thing is like you have to be one of the best teams in the league, and record wise, your team has to have one of the top whatever you make the cutoff, top two, top seed in the conference, whatever, best record in the league. It's got to be the best team in the league, whatever. It's got to be that guy, and he's got to have, you know, a good amount of production. Okay. The problem is, like, when you start really diving into this and you ask the questions, what's really gotten with me is that we can look at the numbers, right? And there's always a pushback on the stats thing. For me, it's more of the stats are not – it's what it's about. The stats are an indicator of what you contributed.
Yeah.
And – the question is, did you contribute so much that you drove winning more than anything else? And with the Suns, I don't wind up being like, man, without Devin Booker, that team would have been, you know, whatever. Or even that's not even the framework that I particularly like, which is, you know, it's because of Devin Booker that they're so good. That's right. Not where I get to. When I watch the Suns, I'm just like, this is the most disciplined team in the league. Yep. And everybody's really good, 1 through 8. Like, everybody knows their role and is content with it. Everybody performs at a high level. Nobody takes possessions off. Nobody is a liability on either end of the floor. They have, like, Ayton is switchable, and Booker's become a good defender, and Booker's a great passer, and Cam Johnson is a terrific role player, and Mikal Bridges is a defensive player of the year candidate who's also got game off the bounce and can shoot. Like, it is that they are disciplined, productive, and efficient at everything together. And that's really become, I think, one of the newer models for success in the NBA, because we had Utah last year in a similar situation. And that's like, I definitely think that Devin Booker's got to be first team all NBA. Like, that's me. Yeah. I think he's got to be first team. Like, 26 points on great efficiency for the number one seed in the league. That to me is like, he's got to get there. But I can't put him in that competition for MVP, because the production gap in terms of impacting the game just isn't there.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that. Like, I will absolutely, in my fake ballot, have Devin Booker as first team all NBA. I can't make an argument against him for first team all NBA. By the way, dealt with Chris Paul injury, dealt with a few different things that could have worked to push Phoenix back toward the Memphis Grizzlies and Golden State Warriors pack, and they just didn't, like, in any way. This was the first year where I felt like, okay, Devin Booker is their best player. He is their most valuable player. He's the guy. Like, this is, before I thought it was Chris Paul, it is now him. And I think that it speaks to the leap that he's taken in terms of the way he has rounded off his game. Similarly to what you said, he's a very good defender now. Yeah. He is not like a liability in any sense of the word. He can switch. He is not getting blasted on switches by any stretch against good players. Like, you can't try to hunt him anymore. Right. There's no way that you're going to be successful doing that, really. Maybe against like Kevin Durant, but like Kevin Durant is going to hunt whoever he wants like, you're just fucked either way. Like, Devin Booker has become a real passer. There were times where I thought that Devin's passing and his assists in some of the early Suns days, when Phoenix fans would come and say, no, he's really improved as a passer, I felt like sometimes it came on his terms a little bit more, where he was dominating the ball so much, and he was making the reads, and he was making those early career stage improvements that you hope to see from a young player. But I didn't know how impactful they were on winning within a team construct. He's now just like an exceptional passer within a team construct, which is huge for them. I am really, really impressed, like, across the board with Devin Booker. And like you said, I just can't get there. Like, I can't get there with the production gap. And that's okay. Mets fans have started to come in with Luka Doncic. And I think that Luka has had an exceptional last 50 games of the season, even. He has had a truly exceptional last month and a half, where I think I'll raise my hand. I think he's been the best player in the league for the last like month and a half, if we're being completely honest with it. But you know what? That first couple of months where he was working his way back into shape, where there was clearly some adjustment with working with a new coach and Jason Kidd, it feels like that should push him down just a level to where he's in the conversation for, again, first team all NBA, not necessarily MVP.
I got bullied into picking him for first team all NBA by Mavs fans, and credit to them for just hammering me with data and arguments and all these things. And like, I caved. I was like, all right, you know what? You got a point. You're right. Luka gets first team all NBA. And if he had, you're right, if he had played the way that he has over the last 50 games, the entire season, he'd be there. There's a popular thing with Mavs fans to be like, well, look at the production in November. And I'm like, okay, let's see the shooting splits. And like, this is the whole thing. It's just like, Luka's hasn't been an insanely efficient shooter the entire season. That just hasn't been who he is. He's not going to be that, because he's basically like, he's James Harden in Houston. That's what they've done. And I argued for Harden. I voted Harden in 2017. And if Luka does what he's done over this last 40 games ish, when they really started to evolve towards this heliocentrism, if he does that next year, the whole way, I'm going to be like, it's Luka Doncic. There's no question. No question. I would say he's been the second best player over the last, what, however month along. I great that he beat Giannis yesterday, but Giannis has done over the last like month in the big game situations that he has, that to me matters.
Yeah.
That's been ridiculous. He's put on, like, I said this morning on Twitter, I try and fight recency bias very hard, and Giannis's recent games have made that very difficult because of what he's done. But with Luka, he's the entire engine. He's the entire offense. He generates, you know, all of this offense all on his own. He has been a better defender this year. He made real efforts this year on the defensive end. We'll see if that holds up next season. He came into the season as the MVP favorite. There was an expectation for him. I did a preseason straw poll, and he was expected to be amongst the top three guys at the end of the season. Like, there's a lot of voters that thought that he was going to be there. He has a real, like, again, we talk about people wanting to vote for him. Everyone's ready to anoint Luka. Like, everyone's there. Everyone's ready for it.
Completely.
He's going to get there. And I think he will. I think next year he's probably, like, as soon as the market opens, I'll be betting Luka Doncic for MVP. Like, I will be betting that number because I think it's probably going to be plus 250 or better. And there's value on that even that far out. But I'm sorry, you got to be in shape to be an NBA player. I don't have to. That's why I do this. Like, you gotta be in shape when you come in, man. And I think if he comes in next year with the intent to win and he commits himself to that, because honestly, Nikola Jokic was at the same point in his career where Luka's at age-wise, where he didn't take his body seriously. And then he started taking his body seriously, and he won an MVP because he was doing what he was capable of every single night. Right. That's the only thing left for Luka, and I think he'll get there, but not this year.
Yeah, and like, that's the thing with players in general, right? Like, and this even goes down to the level that I often watch, which is college basketball, right? Like, everyone right now is asking me, why is Caleb Love, who just dropped 28 on Duke, not a real NBA draft prospect or not like a potential first round pick? I've been higher on Caleb Love from a talent perspective than I think a lot of people have, but it's the game in, game out consistency that he doesn't bring. It's the possession by possession decision making even that he doesn't bring. Cause like, if you go back and you watch that Duke tape, there were three times in that game where he literally just threw the ball to Duke. Like, he got himself in trouble. He jumped up and then just like went, oh shit, where do I go? And then just like threw it, and it went right into Duke's hands for a pick six. And it was an easy 2 points on the other side. So it's the possession by possession. It's the game by game stuff that separates a like NBA player from a non-NBA player, that separates it. The further you up that consistency, it separates the rotation player from the starter level. And then I think it even gets up to the highest levels of MVP, which is what we're talking about right now. I think that game by game consistency is the separator from superstar, super duper star to legitimate MVP candidate at the end of the day.
And when Luka, you know, when really for the first month of the season, if you looked at the Mavs record, because that's a lot of it, right? Is the argument comes, well, wait, hang on. If Luka's got the numbers and they've got a better record, why is he not in this conversation? And my response is because for the first 2 months of the season, the Mavs were winning with defense. Like, Luka had a negative net rating in those games and over that span of time. And it's not that Luka was a drag on them. It just wasn't good enough. They were winning because of a lot of reasons early on, but they were not winning because Luka was dominating. They were just, they were finding ways to win. Now, he's been more impactful to winning than most players, all but maybe the top three, and even questionably some of those guys over the last 30 games of the season. But that's not the entire season. And for me, a lot of it is, I care about those games in November. Like, I care that you came into the season. We're like, we got to stay afloat and win games early on. And the ability to do that from day one, to me, really matters when we get into this conversation, because too often it just becomes who's been really good as of late. If the season was two more months and Luka kept doing what he did, that's probably enough for him to win, but it's not. And so he's in the situation that he's in.
The last two guys I want to mention here, and I'm sorry to Jason Tatum, I think he's probably seventh for me in this conversation. Maybe I'd have him sixth. I might have him ahead of the next guy. Ja Morant has missed 20 games. And I just don't know that we can get to the point where we have Ja Morant in this conversation having missed 20 games.
So I don't understand this. I made the case for Ja, and I don't think he should win, and I don't think he should be top three. And I probably have dropped him now past the top five at this point. What I think is really weird is that there's this whole thing about Ja's missed games. And Luka's played, after this weekend, five more games. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
Five more games. And Ja's probably not coming back this week. There's no real reason for him to. They've locked the two seed. But Luka's also probably not
going to be 10.
But
I'm assuming Luka's going to play the whole week.
Because... I don't think he is, because I think they're probably going to lock four.
Maybe.
So
okay.
If he locks four, it becomes like seven, which is a gap for sure. It's almost 10%.
What? Right, season? 210, 250 minutes, something in that ballpark. Yeah,
like
right?
it matters. It's just been very weird to me that there's this like, Ja Morant has missed all this time.
Well, I think that even more than that, though, too, it's that the Grizzlies have been incredibly successful without Ja Morant.
And that's
the weird part of this conversation that I don't actually know what to do with in my brain.
Yeah, this fundamentally, to me, gets into like how you look at the NBA regular season. And because this is a big deal with me with the Jokic thing. Mm-hmm. I am making the argument for Jokic not based off of, he missed these guys. Look at how hard it was. And instead just based off of, no, like, regardless of who he had and who he didn't, Jokic whipped ass every single night. With Morant, I've always felt this way. I think it's just very strange, especially in the modern age. I'm okay with, like, very slight dividers of, you know, this guy, I think he got to play a minimum number of games, and Ja's not going to get there, and that matters, right? Because, like, right. You need to be at least to the Walton threshold, 57. I do think it's weird, though, to talk about what happens when a guy doesn't play. Because, ultimately, he's not responsible for that. Like, I care very much about what happens when a guy is on the court. He's got to be on the court enough to be in the conversation. It's okay to have those thresholds. But I don't like this idea of, well, they were really good without him, so they didn't need him. So they would have won if he had not played the entire season, is like the extrapolation of that. And where I get to is, I'm like,
to an extent, yeah.
Yeah, and to me, I'm just like, that's not true. Like, we could just look at the season and be like, no, they don't have Ja Morant, they're not the two seed. That's, if you've watched Grizzlies games, that's pretty evident. You're like, but they're so good without him. There's a letdown effect that messes with all of this. And I think one of the things is that Taylor Jenkins in Memphis has done a phenomenal job of taking advantage of those letdown spots of like, nobody believes in you. Nobody thinks you can win. You're without Ja. You're without Jaren. Nobody right. thinks you can win. Like, fuck those guys. Let's go get them. Right. Motivation in the NBA is like the number. That's
by the way, bigger,
go ahead.
I think this goes even beyond Taylor Jenkins. I think it goes up to Zach Kleiman, the Memphis Grizzlies front office. They specifically draft those guys.
Yeah. Like
this is what they do. They look for guys who are motivated and competitive and want to win games like this. They identify them and they select them. And then it goes within their entire cultural ethos as an organization that this is how they want to play. So I think that as much as anything is why you see less of a drop-off effect
right.
than and, you would with Memphis, with or without Ja.
Yeah, and so for me, like, if you want to say he hasn't played enough games, that's a good argument. But when we get into, like, well, they've won all these games without him, so clearly they don't need him, that to me ignores a lot of context of how the NBA regular season works. And I've said this for years, and it continues to be true to me. A bigger factor in injury over the course of an 82 regular game season, not over the course of it, but night by night, on any given night, is motivation. Do you have more? Are you willing to try harder than this other team that's just like, man, it's 3-4. I just want to go home. I just want to go home. Or Phoenix, who, you know, faces Memphis without everybody. And Phoenix is like, you know, we're playing because we're trying to get the record, but we've got the one seed. We're not going to get hurt. We're just kind of going through this, you know? And so that I think gets complicated. When I made the case for Ja, my basic argument was, I think Ja's been the most spectacular player in the NBA this season because all of Ja's games and moments are like they popped off the screen for us month after month after month, like from October through November through December through January through February and into early March. And then he got hurt and then the whole thing fell apart because they kept winning games without him. But like the monster block that he had to save the season, the 42 versus the Lakers, like these performances, these incredible layups that he would have night after night. Like Ja to me, even more than Giannis and even more than Jokic's passing and even more than Luka's step backs, like Ja has done things that were just jaw-droppingly amazing.
Well, he's the aesthetic argument that we mentioned, Jokic and Giannis to an extent, not necessarily having as much as other people. Ja is not pure aesthetics because he's an exceptional basketball player, but that's more of what his case looks like. It's the Derrick Rose case from, what was that, 2012? It's that kind of player and that kind of emergence this year in terms of why they've been successful. The last guy I want to mention is Kevin Durant. And Kevin Durant is not going to hit your Walton threshold of 57 games. He's probably going to hit 55, which I saw that Bill Simmons said on his podcast, the only other player to make first team All-NBA at 55 games is Bernard King in 1985. There is some precedent there for a great player missing a lot of time. I just can't get there. This team is, what, ninth as we speak in the Eastern Conference? And I don't know, man. Like, there's way more context behind why they've been bad, but I don't feel great about voting for a guy that led his team to ninth in the Eastern Conference and missed 27 games.
For me, it's just the games missed. It really is. If he played 10 more, you know, I think it really gets into an interesting argument. 15 more, if he gets above the threshold, I think it becomes a real interesting argument because I think he's been. Any given night in the NBA, you can watch Kevin Durant, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Nikola Jokic and be like, that's the best player in the NBA. And I will even say that, like, it's a lot easier for me to accept Giannis and KD than Jokic, is how I'll put that, right? Like, as much as, I watch Jokic nightly, and yet even I'm like, I watch KD, and I'm just like, whew. Yeah.
If I had to win one game in the NBA tomorrow, right, I think my pick is KD still.
Well, I think
it might be Giannis, but it's one of those two. Like, well, it's one of those two, I think.
Here's what I think is crazy is Jokic shapes the game more than I think any other player in the league. Because if you double him, he kills you. If you single cover him, he kills you. If you zone him, he kills you. If you don't have good backline defense, you're dead. If you don't have good frontline defense, you're dead. Like, he manipulates you and figures out ways, and he's always three steps ahead of what your anticipated rotations are. The things that all NBA teams do to try and make things difficult for great players, he's three moves ahead of you and anticipating and countering it. With KD, it's like, No. You could do whatever you want. It just doesn't matter. You could put a big guy on him, put PJ Tucker on him, put Kawhi Leonard on him, put whoever you want, put Bam Adebayo, Marcus Smart, whoever you want. They're catching 40 because KD's unstoppable. And with Giannis, I think it's like a mix of the two, right? Where, like, he's a really gifted passer, and that's like an underrated part of his game. And he's so amazing on defense. He's the best defender of the three. And he's able to do things like, you know, he's going to block what you thought was an unblockable layup. He's going to grab the ball. He's going to go full court. He's going to Euro step through two guys, and he's going to finish off balance for the M1. Like, those combinations are really difficult to parse. With KD, it sucks because I do think it would have been cool for him to get a second MVP. It's going to be a shame probably that, like, it reduces the chances, I think, dramatically. And for him to do it, to win MVP after suffering an Achilles tear, that's fucking crazy.
I can't fathom that. I can't. What he's doing right now, I can't wrap my brain around it. I really can't. The fact that this guy suffered a torn Achilles in a playoff game while coming back to, like, play a game that, frankly, like, probably shouldn't have been playing in because he was hurt in the first place, and comes back, misses the season, and, like, doesn't miss a beat. Like, he is who he is. That's incredible to me.
Yeah. And so, from that perspective, it would be really incredible to see him do it. But, you know, ultimately, like, he wasn't healthy. And, you know, even if Kyrie had played and they'd been able to win enough games, I think that's part of it. If we get into the narrative discussions, if we're going to say that Embiid deserves credit for holding the team together through the Simmons saga, then I think that KD's enabling of Captain Flat Earth is probably got to be at least partially contributing to the dysfunction that team suffered. And Harden, like, perfectly willing to hold Harden accountable for his own actions, but, like, KD was—he was away from the team, hurt. I think it was part of it. So that's a tough thing to put on his shoulders. But you know, look, ultimately, Kyrie's his guy, and that's who he's backed. And
yeah,
there are consequences to that, like this season.
Okay, so we haven't talked about the one main candidate here. I want to just get into ordering MVP because I feel like we're going to talk about him kind of at the end here. If you had to vote right now, and as you said at the top, I want to give you this very clear out here. This thing is fluid. It really is going to come down to the end of the week. These guys are all that close. Right now, I would have Luka 5. I would have Devin Booker 4. I would have Joel Embiid 3. And then I will save it for the end here in terms of 1 and 2. Who would you have 5, 4, and 3?
Five, I'd have Ja Morant. No, take that back. That's wrong. 5, I would have Devin Booker.
Okay.
4.
Oof. It's pretty gross, isn't it?
4, I'd have Jason Tatum.
Okay. Let's hear the conversation for Tatum real quick. Yeah. I don't want to.
So here's the starting point. Okay. I care most about, like, from my framework, did your team kick the most ass on court? That's like the most succinct way I can do it. It's actually like a more delicate definition. It's were you most impactful towards winning? That's how I decided to define most valuable. Jason Tatum has the best net rating in the NBA amongst qualified leaders. They literally have won by 11 points per 100 possessions with Tatum on the floor this season. They have absolutely kicked the shit out of everyone in the minutes that Tatum has played. Yes, the Celtics are very good. Yes, the Celtics have the best defense. Guess what? Tatum contributes to that. Jason Tatum is an exceptionally underrated defender. Like, Tatum is a great defender. Like, Tatum's a better defender than Devin Booker. He's a better defender than Luka Doncic. He's a better defender than Nikola Jokic. He is not a better defender than Giannis Antetokounmpo. I would put him, honestly, a little bit on the level of Joel Embiid, if we're being perfectly honest, given certain limitations for both. Embiid can't play at the level as well. Tatum obviously doesn't have the size to block shots and rim protect the same way. So, like, really honestly, I think that there are Embiid's impact defensively is going to be greater as a rim protector, but in terms of skill at their positions, I think they honestly are pretty equivalent. That's how much I think of Jason Tatum's defense. The efficiency is through the absolute roof. He's been on absolute tear. It's much like with Luka, where you get into the arguments of the early season inefficiency versus the later season efficiency. Part of it with me also, I will totally admit this, is that I will give, like, we're parsing the very thinnest of threads here. So if I'm allowed that kind of a caveat, I'll say Jason Tatum suffered COVID last year and has openly admitted that it took him months for him to get back from a breathing problem post COVID. Luka Doncic likes to go party and drink. Like, that difference between the two does matter to me about their early season performances. And so for me, like, Tatum, and especially, look, that team could have gone sideways. Like, the Celtics could have spiraled off of the map and been done. Tatum could have very easily been leaking to people like, yeah, it might be time for there to be a change in Boston in terms of the Jaylen Brown relationship, or this team's got to do something, or if they don't make a change soon, Jason Tatum is going to want nothing. Tatum just kept his head down, kept working, and brought them to this point. And for them to be the best team in the NBA over the last 2 months, for them to be so good on both ends of the floor, and for him to be so integral on both sides, to me, that puts him slightly above Booker and it puts him above Luka. I would have Jason Tatum 4th on my MVP ballot today.
Not unreasonable. As we were kind of talking through the Ja stuff at the top, I realized I'd probably have Jason Tatum 6th on mine. So, like, I think that's totally valid argument. Your defensive case on Jason actually is pretty interesting as it refers to Luka Doncic and makes me, like, actually want to rethink a little bit Luka versus Jason. And I probably will do that offline a little bit more as I kind of go into it. But I think the more important part here is that we get into 3-1-2 here. I would assume you have Joel Embiid 3.
Yeah. I've got Embiid 3. I don't know that I've ever worked this hard to find an argument for a guy. Cause usually I'm pretty much just like, well, no, I don't think he's there. But in part, just because the conversation gets to be so toxic, I was like, I don't want that to influence my thing here. I want to really dig to try and find what the argument is. The most sound argument for him, and this is currently still possible for him to reclaim with the Sixers tied in the standings with the Bucks after the Bucks lost to the Mavericks on Sunday, is of the three major candidates, Joel Embiid leads the league in scoring, is a defensive monster, is hugely impactful just in terms of you can't do anything with him, has become a much better passer, especially at double teams. That was always my knock on him. He's been great at that.
Yep.
He works really well with Harden. He's still this season a good mid-range shooter. Last year, he was a great mid-range shooter, falling off a little bit there. But mostly it becomes a ton of rebounds, not like league historic, just a lot of rebounds. Leads the league in scoring for the team with the best record amongst the league in three candidates. That's like the best summation of the argument is lead the league in scoring for the team with the best record of the three candidates. That to me is just not enough. The Sixers have a lot of reasons for their success, none bigger than Joel. The team's still really good. This team still made the conference finals last year. This team still has
conference semifinals.
Conference semifinals. They still, like, Tobias was bad the first part of the year, which is like that's where Embiid really made his bread, right? Like the beginning of the year, like he carried them outside of the COVID bout. Like he carried them, you know. Games played, he's good there. I don't have any argument. Like he's managed to stay on the floor. Especially, I'll say this, for him to have played as much as he has this season, coming off of a torn meniscus last playoffs and not getting surgery so that he could play through it and stay on the floor for his team, a lot of credit to him for fighting through that. Defensively, he's played more at the level this season, which I think is really good for their defense. It's helped, I think, in a lot of ways.
It's another tool to bring out of the bag.
Yeah, it's another tool to bring out of the bag.
Another club.
Still most comfortable in drop, which means he's susceptible to floaters and getting torn up in certain, like that's always going to be a stick in my craw when you're not a guy that can switch 1-5 defensively. Not that like Joker can do that because he can't.
Hence why you are the leading proponent of the Rudy Gobert hatred fan club.
Less that and more just guys gotta get a hook shot. You gotta get a hook shot. With Joel, I think all of these things are really good arguments. It's just not enough. The argument for Joel is really good. Like I said earlier, he's deserving. You know, historically, if Joel gets voted MVP, I'm not going to be like, I can't believe that we gave MVP to that guy.
And I do think it will age well for what it's worth. Like, I think this is probably a real – something that I think is probably happening in voters' minds is – and I am not worried about this because I think that Nikola Jokic is probably going to go down as a top 20 player of all time.
Yeah.
I think that something that's happening in voters' minds right now is – if we give Jokic a second MVP, it is going to put him into like this class of player that is different, right? Yeah. There are very, very few players. Will this age like Steve Nash winning back-to-back MVPs do this? Personally, I'm not worried. Nikola Jokic is going to go down as one of the best players to ever play basketball in the NBA. I think he is staggeringly good. I think they're going to win a title at some point. So I am not wildly worried about how it's going to age. I think that a Joel Embiid MVP winning one once will age well. Like it would age really, really well. There was a point here for this year, last year, probably next year, and in the preceding 2 years where when he was on the court, he was one of the most dominant forces in the NBA. And I think it would be fine to reward that on some level. Again, I'm like just kind of saving Giannis for the end, but nonetheless.
I think Joel is he's a phenomenal candidate. You're right that it'll age well because people will look back at this era and talk about Embiid. I think would help if he had like a dominant playoff run. I think that would help.
Yeah.
Like, I think that would do, like, this has been one of the very weird things to me is there's this whole idea of like playoff success. And I'm like, my man, like Joker's made a conference finals.
Yeah.
Like Joker's won series. He beat Kawhi Leonard and Paul George and was the best player in that series.
Yeah.
Joel got beat by Trae Young.
Yeah.
Like we need to make sure that we keep our history straight here. Now,
I don't think there's literally no argument people can make about Jokic's playoff success, in my opinion. Yeah. Like he has been staggeringly good in the playoffs. Yeah. Now, like up until the last couple of years, like when he took this leap into MVP, like his numbers would consistently rise in the playoffs. It's impossible basically for his numbers to rise any farther now. Right. So that doesn't really happen anymore, but they stay steady now in the way that you would hope. Most guys, like there is a very small, the average in terms of efficiencies and in terms of points, the average is what Pelton has it at like a 10 to 15% decrease. And that just doesn't happen with Nikola.
Yeah. And so now look, this is all with the caveat. You and I both know that, you know, postseason doesn't factor in. It obviously does. There is with some voters, I think there is a concern of like, I don't want this vote to look bad later.
I think that's a real thing. Yeah.
I think that's the Westbrook corollary, you know, and I don't think that Westbrook was a bad MVP. I really don't. I still think I look back at that and I go, look in the, all you can do is make the decision in the moment. You can't start going down the road of like, what's the future going to hold? Cause you don't know, like, you don't know what that's going to hold. And I think most voters know that. And that's ultimately why Jokic has taken the lead and will probably win again. Like that, the reason not to vote Joker is he going to be able to win a title? Like who's more likely to win a title? Joel Embiid with James Harden or Nikola Jokic with whatever MPJ is going to be, Jamal Murray coming off of an ACL, Aaron Gordon, et cetera. You know, like who's got a better path to a title? And like the answer is like clearly Joel. But we don't know what the turns are going to be. And all you can do is base it off of where we're at right now. And ultimately with Embiid, Joker is a better rebounder this season. He's not as good of a scorer, but he is a more efficient one. The efficiency gap is monstrous just in terms of Joker's so much more efficient. Joker creates more for his teammates, all these types of things. Giannis, same kind of deal. Joel is the way I've come up with these, like, what's the four-word definition of their case? Like, Ja Morant is most spectacular. Giannis Antetokounmpo is most dominant.
Yeah.
Joel Embiid is most unstoppable. Like, you can't do anything with him. There's nothing you can do. Like,
yeah.
Do whatever you want. He's going to get – like he's either scoring or he's getting your free throws. There is nothing you can do. Nothing. Yeah. You can double team him, and that's going to be a successful strategy versus the other options. He's become a better passer, a good enough passer to punish you for it, and he still draws a lot of fouls out of double teams. There's nothing you could really do versus Joel Embiid, and that's a good candidate. It's just – he's just not quite at the level of the other two.
Okay. Who would you have 1 and 2?
Tuesday morning I had Joker. Wednesday morning I had Giannis. Thursday morning I had Joker. Friday morning I had Giannis. Saturday morning I had Giannis. Sunday night I have Joker. As we record this on Monday, I'm at Joker just by so few amounts. I do think
We haven't talked the case for Giannis yet, and I want to do that. So I have Giannis at 1. So okay. I want to hear your case for Giannis because I think it is interesting.
It's most dominant. I don't remember a player since Shaq in Orlando where it's just like, The mid-range stuff really does matter. I pulled a shot chart, and I've got to give up on Twitter, and I'm putting it in my article that just shows that the evolution of his shot chart over the last 4 years. And it really does, like, you go, you just go, holy shit, because it goes from all these blues in terms of negative true shooting percentage versus league average to red. And even on the perimeter, it's not that he's this crack shooter. It's that he's good enough to where it's just, and you can, if you watch if you go through and you watch all the possessions in the game, what you'll see is even if he faces these big front lines that are able to slow him down, he'll stop and be like, all right, I'm going to go to the one legged step back jumper. And he misses one. And they're like, okay, this is going to work. And then he hits one. And they're like, okay. Okay, well, he's going to go for that, so I'm going to try and just contest a little bit more this time. Oh, nope, he got you. You fell for it. Now he's around you and he's dunking. Okay, well, let's back up. Let's protect that rim again. And he does it again. And he misses, and you're like, okay, we got him. And then he hits one, and they're like, okay, I'm going to step up a little bit. The discipline it takes to defend Giannis, you have to be disciplined. You have to be huge. You have to have great hands. The Toronto Raptors are the only team that has a combination to do it effectively. Like, and everybody
great feet as well,
else.
By the way, it's not just like great feet as well.
Yeah. Like,
it's impossible.
He's got moves upon moves. Now his bag really has expanded. The pull-up threes are enough. It's just like, again, it's not that he's a good shooter. It's that it's enough for it just to be enough to, on top of everything else, for it to work. Teams are terrified of him defensively.
Yes.
Like, ball handlers get it. And they're just like, fuck this, I'm out. No, I'm not going against this. Like, there's just no point in it because of what he brings to the table. The passing's really underrated. The fact that he's able to work in pick and roll, he's such a good cutter on top of everything else. He's like, you talk about leader and a competitiveness. What guy goes like this every single game and shows up for so many games? Joel played in a lot of big games late in the season, to his credit. Early on in the season, Joel was getting a lot of rest nights on national TV performances. Not trying to tear him down, but I'm simply going to state that conversely, Giannis is almost always there. And regardless of the matchup or how tough it is. And honestly, this is a big part of it, Sam, is the fact that every team's like, well, we got to foul him and just make him earn it at the line. And he's had those free throw struggles, and he's just like, I don't care. And he'll airball a mid-range jumper, and then he'll take another one and hit it. Like, he has no fear at all of anything, and he still wants to rip your throat out every minute of every game. And that competitive spirit combined with the defense, combined with the scoring, combined with the efficiency, combined with the rebounding, all of that – he is an unparalleled all-around player in NBA history.
And here's the other thing. You mentioned the on-ball defense, which is accurate. Like, you can't get by him on the ball. If it's a switch, it's done. The guard is giving the ball up. This year, he's had to play more of a primary rim protector role. He's had to play the same secondary rim protection role because a lot of the time they play Bobby Portis at center, right? They play these guys like Serge Ibaka late in the season that – aren't quite as mobile as what Serge used to be. Or Bobby Portis, not a particularly strong rim protector. And Giannis has taken on even greater responsibility for Milwaukee this year as the primary guy who has been forced to be at the rim all the time, constantly, every possession, contesting shots. He hasn't fouled. He hasn't bitched about it. He hasn't complained. There's been nothing there. He has had to account for Brooke Lopez's loss throughout the entire season. And he's been spectacular at it. He is the reason, because as you've said, Chris Middleton, Drew Holiday, been in and out of the lineup. A lot of guys with Milwaukee been in and out of the lineup throughout the course of the season. A lot of their best defenders have not always been available. He's been the guy that's held their defense up to about, I don't know what they rank as today. What are they? Probably like 10th to 12th defensively in the NBA right now, which, look, if you want to hold that against him in terms of defensive player of the year, I don't know that I would agree, but I'll listen to the argument about wanting to have a defender that's on one of the best teams in the NBA, like voting for Marcus Smart because the Celtics have been by far the most dominant defense in the NBA, and he's been the captain of the best defense. Giannis Antetokounmpo has been undeniably one of the three best defenders in the NBA. Like, I cannot come up with a framework that does not include him within that regard.
I agree. So this is where it does get tricky. Okay. So dunksandthrees.com's adjusted defensive rating based off of strength of schedule has them 15th in defense.
Yep.
With Giannis on the floor, it's 107.7 and that's unadjusted on NBA.com, 111.5 with him off the floor. So it's 3.8 points better. 107.7 is still a really good mark. It's not elite. It's still like a really good mark. It's, you could just like, Giannis's defense factors into the MVP conversation. Like, to me, like, a lot of the defensive metrics do kind of knock at his case for DPOY. Everyone kind of wonders about the defensive metrics. Like, that's very popular to be like, well, these metrics are bad at evaluating defense. I'm like, that's true, which is why, like, you got to use like 10 of them and the eye test, and you got to talk to people. Like, if you do all that, then you have a pretty good, you can get a good composite, a starting point for understanding defense. But like, there's no question that just, if you, by any measure, if you just look at, if you watch these games and you watch when a guy is challenged by Giannis, other than Luka, because he's insane, the opponent, if Luka is on their ball handler, the ball handler is just so often like, I'm not going to challenge this guy. Like, I'm just, there is, this is not a matchup I can win. And when you have NBA players being like, I can't win this matchup, that's a huge defensive value. Yes. So for me,
24 second shot clock, like that time goes. You bring it down, you're at 20, you know, and then you get the first action, and Giannis is typically the first action. He breaks it and denies it. You're down to 12, essentially, on the shot clock. You're basically getting a hideous shot because Giannis exists and teams are just not willing to try him.
And there are all these moments throughout the season where, because what you're really talking about is like, you try and take the holistic view of all these possessions, which is why, like, I sit down and I try and watch all of them. I try and watch all the offensive possessions and all the defensive possessions. Like, I just try and like sit there for hours and hours and hours with it running, and catch as much as I can by osmosis. What's interesting, I think, is Joker has all these moments where he will take over the game and pull his team out of the depths of what would be an atrocious loss and turn it into a win because he is so singularly dominant. He's done it versus the Clippers, and he's done it in all these kind of spots. But if you look at the record versus teams over 500, the Nuggets are terrible because they don't have the guys. Like, that's where this whole argument about the injuries come in, is like, they don't have the horses to run with these dudes. One of Giannis's biggest arguments, in my opinion, honestly, has come in the last 2 weeks, where you have this stretch in the Nets game. They are down 9. It's the end of his third quarter stint into the fourth quarter before he takes his mid fourth quarter break. And Giannis scores 15 straight fucking points. And Giannis is just like, nope, we're back in this. Like, he goes end to end to end to end to end to end. And the Nets, meanwhile, are just like, what is happening? Like, what do we do? He has the same thing versus the Sixers, where it's like, they've got it. They've got it. They've got, nope. Giannis just decided this thing was over. And that ability to control not just games, but high pressure, high leverage games versus the best teams in the NBA is, to me, like, that's why I was Giannis until Sunday morning. Like, this is what the crux comes down to, is if you ask me possession by possession over the course of the season, who's been more impactful, I think it's been Joker. If you ask me who's been more impactful in the moments his team needed him to be most impactful, it's probably Giannis. And trying to parse those two is why my head's going to explode.
Yep. So all of what you said and all of what I said in terms of holding up this defense by like the like Atlas, essentially, is why I do have Giannis at number one. And like, frankly, at the end of the day, when it comes down to it, I am someone that thought about the way that, not that it was going to age, but more about the way, if I had to pick one player to win a game right now, would I pick Giannis or Jokic? If I had to pick one player to win a game, literally tomorrow, I'd pick Giannis. I would pick Giannis. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I do think that stuff matters. Like, I think that it matters to pick the best player, period, point blank. And like, we just went through all of the arguments, and I think that all of the arguments for both people are incredibly compelling. And if you need to get down to the level where you're parsing X, Y, and Z things, right? And you're parsing, you know, 45 different angles because these two guys are so close, I think it's fine just to have the tiebreaker being like, I just think this dude's better. Like, I think this dude is a better two-way player than Nikola Jokic is. At the end of the day, I do. I'm sorry. I love Nikola Jokic. I think he's great. I would have him number two. I think
that's sound, really, except
other than only maybe Kevin Durant.
My only argument against you there is this. The award is not a conceptual one, right?
It's not, no.
It's based off of, like, this is important, at least from the way that I approach it. Because I often say this is, like, whenever anyone says the argument about LeBron, which is, like, how the fuck does LeBron not have more MVPs? My thing is, I'm like, it's not about, like, who's the better player on any given night or in a one game. It's what have you done? This is a resume. It's a what did you do this season? This is, we have the evidence, right? It's not trying to parse skill set in conceptual environments. It's about, you got 82 games. How many of them did you play? Did you play enough? Okay. Did your team win
enough?
It's
almost an exam. Like, it's a score on an exam.
Exactly. And you have, like, these qualifiers, right? Of the way I do it, at least, is, did you play enough games? Yes. Did your team win enough games? Were you over 500? Yes. Did you win the minutes where you were on the floor? Yes. By how much? Was it enough for it to be significant? Because, like, Ja Morant and Luka Doncic are both, like, plus 3.4, 3.8. It's not good enough. Like, Joker's at plus 8. Yep. He jumped over Giannis over the weekend. All these things kind of factor in. And so what you kind of come down to at the end of the day, honestly, a lot of this, this would be my biggest pushback on you. Giannis in the early season was without Chris and was without Drew and was without Brooke. And that was a hard environment. It really was. And they still managed to be, like, around 500 and hang. And the Nuggets were under 500 for a little bit. And that deserves some consideration too. But ultimately, like, Giannis's early performance wasn't nearly as awe-inspiring as his middle and late season, much the way with Luka and Tatum. And so what you have here,
offensively, I would agree with you.
Yeah.
Defensively, I'm a little bit less sold on that. But
so let me go ahead and I'll break this down.
I understand your point, though, nonetheless.
I want to make the Joker defensive argument real quick.
Yeah.
Okay. The metrics work against him, which is really obnoxious. He's first a defensive box plus minus, and so everyone goes, "Well, that's stupid. You can't use that." And there's almost like a reverse effect here, again, with the cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Like,
which is, I totally agree with you. It is actually very unfair that this,
like,
is happening.
Joker can't be the best defensive player in the league. And then it becomes, he's not even a good defensive player. And I'm like, I'm here to tell you, as somebody that laughed at Adam Mara as my co-host on Locked On Nuggets, 3 years ago, he said, I think Nikola Jokic can be as good of a defender in pick and roll coverage specifically as Marc Gasol.
Yeah. I remember when Adam said that, actually, weirdly.
Is Joker as good as Marc Gasol was? No, Marc Gasol was a fucking defensive player of the year. He's one of the best defensive players of the last, like, 15 years.
Yeah.
But defensively in pick and roll with the scheme that they found for him, which they've honestly used less of this year, he got to be really good. This year, he's even better. He's got great hands. He's got great positioning. He has multiple game-saving, game-winning blocks. He makes the effort that you want as a rim protector. This is a lot of it is, okay, What's a big's job in the NBA these days? Play drop coverage, get your hands up, don't foul, contest the shot, make it hard on them, and that's it. Depending on the coverage, like, are there exceptions?
You know what though? Too, I think that you mentioned the idea of what the scheme was previously, and the scheme was more of a flatter coverage where Nikola would not quite hedge, but he'd play flatter and then recover back, and or play flatter and a guy would string him out, and he'd have to kind of manage on his own out on an island, and he was pretty okay at it, like not. Yep. Disastrous by any stretch by the end. I think that having that versatility in the bag is really important. Like, I think that teams know they could go back to it while they haven't played it as much as what they have previously. And I've seen it like here and there this year, but for the most part, they are playing more drop coverage. I think having both things in the bag is really important for him and really important in regard to evaluating his defense.
Yeah. Like, I don't have any sort of thing I can point to tell you that he's a negative on the defensive end.
Yeah, I agree with you. I actually think he's a plus. Like, I genuinely believe he is a plus defender in the NBA. Like, if we're getting to where, like, we're parsing through, okay, I don't think he's as good as Joel. I don't think he's as good as Giannis. He's way better than Luka. He is a better defensive player than Devin Booker, even though Devin Booker, I think, has gotten to the point where he's pretty solid. I don't think he's quite as good as Jason Tatum, to be honest. I think there's a case, though, that, like, impact-wise, because he plays a more important defensive position, I'd listen in terms of what his impact is. I would still take Tatum, but, like, I would listen. He's a better defensive player than Ja Morant. I think he's probably a better defensive player at this point than Kevin Durant. Kevin ends up taking some possessions off here and there because he's, you know, 32 years old or whatever, and that's okay. Like, sometimes we all need to take defensive possessions off when we're coming off of long-term Achilles injuries and everything. But Jokic is now somewhere in the middle of the pack among MVP candidates defensively, I think, is the point that I'm trying to make.
Well, here's what's great about this argument. Joker is 2 points. The Nuggets offense is 2 points better offensively when Joker is on the floor than the Bucks offense is when Giannis is on the court. It's 117 to 115. The Bucks defense is 2 points better at 107 than Joker's Nuggets defense is when he's on the court at 109. Like, that the impact there is like almost negligible.
And you know what? Like, one other thing I do want to mention with Jokic as well defensively, he is very clearly the captain out there. Like, you watch the way that they kind of communicate, watch the way that they are moving around out there, rotating. He's the guy that's kind of captaining it out there. He's the one that's kind of pulling the strings and holding it together. He's not a elite defender. I wouldn't even say that like he is in the 80th percentile or higher defender in the NBA, but he's somewhere in that like 65 to 75 range, I think. Like, he's a legit positive defender now.
Yeah. And the gap between him and Giannis is still monstrous.
Yes.
Which matters, except for that the Bucks defense hasn't been elite. Like, that to me is like maybe the counter draw here is just like, well, look, and I'm making the other argument here. On the same token, you can also go like, well, look, Joker may have been a better defender this season, and it may be actually 60th or 70th percentile. The Nuggets defense still sucks. So he's not actually impacting anything on that end anyway, because nobody on Denver can stop anything at the point of attack. And they need somebody who's better at rim protection than what Nikola Jokic can be. Like, they need Rudy Gobert in order for that defense to work, because that's how terrible their point of attack defense is. So like, all of this evens out. To me, if it's Giannis, if it's Joker, the arguments to me really do negate, and it winds up being like either one I'm okay with. I'm good with either one. I think it does need to be one of those two guys. If it's Joel, I'm gonna be like, not what I think should have happened, but a perfectly reasonable choice. If it's Joker or if it's Giannis, I'm gonna be like completely worthy MVP. Like, that those were the two guys this season that I point to over the entire course of it. A lot of it with Joker gets into those advanced metrics that are always kind of like banned. I did this the other day where I looked up all three of their individual stat lines for thresholds of not using anything complicated, just points, rebounds, assists.
Oh, you brought this up on Twitter earlier. This is a really good one.
And all three of them are having historic seasons. Like, nobody's ever had the points, rebounds, and assists mark that Joker has had.
Yep.
Not VORP, not EPM, not BPM, not win shares. Points, rebounds, assists. Nobody's done what he's done in NBA history. Giannis, I believe it's like, if you do all that, if you put together his scoring numbers with rebounds and stocks, is where it gets into like, nobody's done what he's done. With Joel, I think it's points, rebounds, I want to say an efficiency, something, maybe blocks. All three of them are basically had like, nobody's done what these guys have done on the very basic level. And it shows you like how incredible this year is. These guys really, and this is in a very difficult season with COVID and injuries on a short off season and everything else. Like, all three of them have had extremely fucked up seasons in terms of their team injury and whatever Ben Simmons qualifies as. And they've all managed to make it into the postseason. If Embiid, I'll say this too. If the Sixers had just won a few more damn games down the stretch, I think that Joker, that Embiid had a real case at this thing. He needed to get more than a 2-game separation over Denver. That to me is like a lot of this. He had a chance at it and couldn't close the deal. And it sucks that recency bias is a thing, but you only have how many games. And the Sixers, for Joel to make up the gap between the efficiency and the other two, they needed to get a better record by 2-3 games more in order to really get that separation.
Please, I just beg everyone, when you're making your case for your player, just don't like don't be negative about other guys. These guys are all having historic seasons. They're all having incredible years. Let's remember that we're in the midst of an incredible season where we have three guys that are doing genuinely historic things, as opposed to trying to tear down Joel Embiid or Nikola Jokic or Giannis Antetokounmpo because you want to. All three of these guys have been unbelievable, and I just really am excited to see the way that the MVP race shakes out. Matt Moore, tell the people where they can find you. Tell the people what you've got going on.
Download the Action Network app. You know, track your bets. Get updated second scores. Just if you're like, I want to know when halftime ends. It's got a halftime counter, so that way you can go get your snack and then come back and know exactly when you're going to have it. That'll have all my coverage on MVP. You can follow me on Twitter at HB Basketball. I've got a podcast called Buckets, which you can check out wherever you get podcasts. Thanks so much for having me, Sam. I love talking to you. I miss you so much, buddy.
I miss you too. I am so happy we got to do this. Please go subscribe to the Action Network, and please go download the Action Network app. It saves my life every day when I'm betting. It is the absolute best betting app on the market, I think. I love it unconditionally when it comes to tracking your bets. And we'll be back later this week on Wednesday. I will have Matt Penny on Friday. I'll have another show forthcoming. But until next time, we will talk soon. Bye.